better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3,555 of the Survival Podcast. It is Tuesday, September the 10th, 2024, and we're doing another throwback show today. This is basically a topic I've covered, quite a few times in the past, which is the concept of from home to homestead. And when I say throwback, I mean throwback, like NFL QB 70-yard throwback, right? Like all the way out and down the field. The very first time I ever used the term from home to homestead on this show was episode 20 of the Survival Podcast. It was recorded on July 22nd, 2008. The concept so resonated with people of moving our mindset from home to homestead that a few things happened. One, it became a defining component of the future of the show. I would say that it was as dominant in, early discussions, just in general, on air, off air, in the communities, everything, as the concept of, I used a lot of times back in the day, the old fable, the ant and the grasshopper, to talk about preparedness, mainly because, my granddad was really a fan of that show or that story, and he told me that story all the time. But it hit some folks. Some of y'all might have been around long enough to remember Johnny Max and the Queen. They were podcasters back in the day, too. They already had a show on beer, a home brewing podcast. It was one of the, at the time, of course, there was a lot less podcasts back then, one of the most successful podcasts there was on iTunes is what it was, not Apple Podcasts back then, it was iTunes. But they came out with a second podcast that was completely dedicated to the concept of home to homestead. And so we hit all kinds of like high notes with this concept. And it's never stopped being part of what we do, but maybe we just don't use the exact same words. And what I'm doing with it this time, beyond just home to homestead, is, well, where did that all come from? The wisdom of our grandparents. And when I say our grandparents, I do mean mine, and I will reference both sides of my family, my grandparents today, because they were, they were older members of their own generation, right? If there's no way that they could possibly still be with us today, because all four of them would be among the oldest people in the world ever. Outside maybe the Bible or something like that. In fact, I think they would all be the oldest people ever lived. They'd be competing with each other. So what I'm saying is that they remember the days, not just of the Depression, but before it. Most of my grandfathers served in the military during World War II, and they were kind of old men for their time in the military. My grandfather on mom's side actually was a warrant officer in the Army Intelligence Corps at that time, and was in the Pacific Theater during World War II. But, could clearly articulate to me what it was like being a very young person, but an adult, during the Great Depression, and choosing the military service long before the war was announced because he wanted a job. That's how that all started. So I'm going to be definitely referring to them. But when I say our grandparents, I literally mean ours. Like if you're alive today, your grandparents, even if they're still with us and you're lucky, but especially if you're my age or close to it or older, then your grandparents are all part of that GI and silent generation, lost generation world, right? So we're going to talk about the wisdom they had that we've kind of cast aside today. Before we do that, let us go ahead and take care of our sponsors of the day today. Sponsor of the day number one today is KnifeKits.com. KnifeKits.com has been a sponsor of the Survival Podcast since 2012. Here we are 14 years later. They're still supporting the show. You can go to KnifeKits.com right now, and you can get everything you need to have to start building knives yourself. It's a great father-son, mother-son, father-daughter, uncle, nephew, granddad, grandson project to do, and you can make something truly unique. I assure you that your first knife will not be your best knife you ever make if you make more than one. But you know what? It may be priceless to that kiddo you make it with. Maybe one day he'll be talking about the wisdom of his grandparents or his dad or something and show somebody the knife y'all made together. And there's a lot of ways to personalize them, like their cool mosaic pins and other things like that. You can also get stuff for making Kydex holsters, leather holsters. They even have blue guns for that kind of work. Just a great company. Again, been with us 12 years. So check them out today at knifekits.com. Next up, you know, one of our newer sponsors, actually, even though they've been with us quite a while now, several years, Start9, Sovereign Computing. If you want to take back your digital sovereignty, Start9 is the way to do that. You can set up end-to-end encrypted messaging that, I mean, is completely like military-grade bulletproof encryption. And even your non-techie family and friends can use it because to them it's just an app that they install and you have to approve them to let them in. You can store all your data, access it from anywhere. You can run a Lightning node. You can run a straight-up Bitcoin node. There's a ton of stuff that you can do. And if you can install an app on your computer, and if you can use those apps, then you can run a Start9 server. Now, if you're coming to the workshop, Jesse Markowitz is going to actually actively install and set up and demonstrate what Start9 can do for you right here at the November workshop. We'll say more about that in a minute. But another thing to know about Start9 is, you know, it's not cheap. It's not super expensive. It's not cheap either. So a 9% discount is a pretty good discount. Well, if you are looking to get started with Start9 and you're an MSB member, you can get a great, and I mean a great, discount of 9%. And if you stack that using a Fold gift card, that's another 9%. You can get 18% off whatever you're looking to buy at start9.com. With that, real quick before we get into the episode today, I want to also give you a little more information about the fall workshop. Yesterday, I gave you the list of instructors and what they're going to be teaching. Today, what I want to do is tell you a little bit about what you're going to be eating if you come. And so today, I put out kind of the annual thing that I do about 2 weeks before tickets go on sale. I always put this out. It tells you who's going to be speaking, what they're talking about, you know, titles of their talks, all the extra stuff we're going to do, and the full menu as well. Well, here's the menu. Just to tell you why I think this is, we do a good job, I think, of delivering value at these things. First day, breakfast, we always just do light continental. That gives the kitchen staff time to get up to speed. So it's like, you know, protein bars and fruit and coffee and stuff like that, juice and what have you. But I was doing the freezer inventory, which I always do this time of year, and found 12 packs of sockeye salmon lox, which are the very thin sliced cured salmon. Reached out to Ken Daniels, who's going to be teaching here. So the first day we're adding a bagel, you know, bagel bar, basically just a ton of really cool toppings, bagels warmed up, the salmon lox, cream cheese, all kinds of cool stuff that Ken is going to handle the bulk of doing that. For lunch, we're having sage salt rubbed center cut boneless pork chops with celery and sage stuffing, gravy, and green beans. And then that night we'll have rotisserie chicken, roasted potatoes, and buttered corn. That might sound pretty good. It only goes uphill from here. We start out kind of at the bottom end of what we do, and we go, you know, we build as we go forward. So Friday we'll have bacon and egg breakfast tacos with all the toppings. If the ducks get off their butts and start cranking eggs out again and we don't have to, you know, segue enough for our customers, it'll be Nine Mile Farm duck eggs. If not, there'll be, you know, Nine Mile Farm chicken eggs. But we just may not have enough ducks eggs for that. We'll have a build-your-own burger bar on Friday afternoon for lunch. For dinner, we are bringing in a new caterer because we've tried them and we like them better than Uncle Julio's, who we've used for the last few years. They're called Lupe Tortilla is the name of the restaurant. They're going to be doing steak and chicken fajitas with queso, guacamole, salsa, and chips. Basic, you know, Tex-Mex, really great. And they're going to be cooking on-site, bringing the pit out just like Uncle Julio's does. But then we're going to also have the margarita machine set up. We're going to be doing virgin margaritas. Don't worry. We will have tequila. And if you want it, some Grand Marnier or whatever, so you can mix them your own strength. But that way, if we have, you know, a person that's not drinking age or doesn't drink or whatever, they can still participate in it. And then Saturday, breakfast will be my breakfast sausage. It's a sage-based breakfast sausage with fresh baked biscuits. Don't tell Ken Berry. We're going to have biscuits, scrambled eggs, and cream gravy. That's about as Texas breakfast as it gets. Lunch is going to be sirloin tamales, Chef Michael's chili, and we're going to be doing cornbread. And instead of putting stuff in the cornbread, which is what we've always done, I'm going to make a cilantro jalapeno compound butter so the people that like jalapenos are too hot don't have to worry about it. And I think you get more flavor that way, too. Dinner on Saturday night is the epic dinner. And I think this year maybe we've gone further than we ever had. I got really big into sausage making this summer, and I've done like prototypes and like perfected these three recipes. So there'll be a flight of sausages, just three full-size links per person. Hickory smoked brisket and jalapeno, mesquite smoked pork, apple, sage, and fennel, and I'm getting strange. Good night. That's like he kicked the afterburners in. I can't even hear myself. Bro, get out of here. Anyway, mesquite smoked pork, apple, sage, and fennel sausage, and then we're going to have pimento wood smoked. Yes, I've gone out and bought the actual pimento wood that they make Jamaican jerk chicken over in Jamaica, so I can properly smoke a Jamaican jerk chicken sausage. In addition to that, we'll have hickory smoked pork shoulder, Chef Michael's cowboy beans, and roasted potatoes and carrots. And there's a ton more stuff that's going on. You can read the article for that. And yeah, Hugs says that they're coming for me. I think they were, man. That was close. I looked over and literally could see the window vibrate on that one. And I didn't hear him coming in, right? I didn't hear it come. It was like they came over quiet and then kicked it in right over my roof. Maybe they don't like what I'm talking about today, since it's very freedom oriented. I mean, they're supposed to be the defenders of freedom, but you know, that's not probably military pilots. That's probably test pilots for Lockheed making some money there. All right, and it's not that Ernie says, Jack's flying over my homestead. Lockheed's right over there, guys. It happens all the time. That was just crazy loud. All right, so let's talk about this. Like I said, you know, when I was at episode 20, I was in July. Let's see, July 22nd of 2008. I was still recording the podcast in my car. I was using a little bitty MP3 recorder that I paid like $30 for. And I think by then I had at least moved to this like piece of shit old Plantronics headset that plugged into it that I found, and that made the audio a little bit better. And I did an episode that was called From Home to Homestead. And when I did that episode, it was one of those first early episodes that people actually started sharing the shit. Like, you got to hear this guy. You got to listen to what he's talking about. This is how our grandparents used to be, and this is how we should be. And like I said, it took on a life of its own. It became a meme within a meme, sort of, so to say. And when I talked about it, I actually invoked something that I'll do right now that really isn't what you think of in this realm, I guess. And that is a much more modern concept, and that is Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Now, whenever I mention that book, I always say we know full on that that's really a work of fiction with a little bit of his childhood actually mixed into it. But by using a storyline, he was able to teach these lessons. It's not supposed to be read as being really the truth of what happened when he was a kid. But one thing he said in there that really stuck with me, and I discovered that book on tape, right, when I was in those years, those formative years of my career and trying to build my knowledge. And I remember driving around in my car and hearing him say that most people think that their greatest asset is their home. And I believe they're coming back. Hopefully it won't be as loud as last time. But I believe at the first point that I heard that, I didn't even own a home yet. I was still renting an apartment. And maybe that made it a little easier for me to accept what he was saying. He said, but your house, for most people, does not belong in the asset column of your personal balance sheet. It belongs in the liability column. And the reason is that most people, if they lost their job for 2 or 3 months maximum, be in danger of having their house foreclosed. Their house produces no income for them. All it is an expense and a place that they live, and that most people – and I would say it's probably even more true now, or at least it was. I mean, now nobody's buying houses because nobody can afford to. But most people would overpay, not necessarily for the value of the home, but overpay what they really could afford to service. And so they basically had this incredible financial risk that they put in the wrong side of the balance sheet and thought was actually this huge asset. And he said, you know, the asset value of it is what is your house worth, you know, minus what you owe. And if that number is bigger, then the balance is a liability. And that made a lot of sense to me. So when I started this show, that was still in my head. I was still thinking about that concept. And I had worked hard to change that for myself. And I'm like, I don't want to go out and pay full price for my house. Interest rates are really low, and I can do more with the money. And you know, Kiyosaki wasn't really opposed to buying the house, and I wouldn't do it if he, or wouldn't worry about it if he was anyway. But the concept was solid. So I'm like, well, how can I make the house an asset? And there were certain things I had to do. One was, when we bought a house, we made sure that we felt like, even if we both lost our good jobs, you can call them that, at the time anyway, and we had to go out and get jobs working at Walmart, we could still afford the house. So we needed to mitigate the liability concept with, as long as we can function and hold an adult full-time job, we'll be able to pay for it. And so we needed enough money down. We needed everything, you know, every kind of debt that we had that was a bad debt, and I did have some bad debts back then, and so did Dorothy. Okay, first we're going to pay those off. And the real estate agent's like, but you don't have to. Your credit's good enough. No, we have to for us. And so we dug ourselves out of our debt hole, and we picked the house, and we were really careful in that first buy. We made good money on it, and every time we moved, we were able to do a little bit better with our home without actually paying more money for it. Like, my house payment today, thank God I bought when I did, but it's not much more than my first house payment when I bought my first house in 1998. And it's a hell of a lot nicer of a place than I had in 1998, because we've always been able to roll equity, right? And by doing that, that was one piece of it. But the other thing was, well, what did my grandparents do? Because this is the wisdom of our grandparents. And well, my grandparents, both sides, grew food. And I'm like, you know, we have this backyard, and there's space out there that we don't really do anything with except mow. So we put in a garden, and we planted some fruit trees and all the stuff that we talked about. And so this is pre-TSP, guys. I'm like, this is what I did with my first house in Arlington. It's what I did with the house we owned in Pennsylvania when we were up there for a few years and I worked for Fluke. When we moved back here, we bought a place also in Arlington, Texas, that I was actually living in when I started the show. And we had done it there in a big way. And so it was natural for me then to get on the air and teach this concept. Let's stop making the house an actual liability. Now, I do owe money on my house today, but it is such a low amount of money. I could set the difference in what I could sell it for, the equity I would pull out, exceeds the owed. So it literally is an asset in that it's holding equity value. I have underlying value that exceeds the debt. I probably could sell this house today and walk away with about $350,000. And I don't want to say exactly what I owe on it, but I'll just say it's a hell of a lot less than that. That would be a net after you pay for everything and walk away, what I could walk away with in my pocket. So I don't consider my house just economically a liability anymore. I really do see it as an asset because I believe that's what it is. Plus, then we did all the other things to make a cash flow out of the property. So the property actually produces in total value more money than servicing the mortgage every year. If I look at it from a true business standpoint, of course, I'm sitting in my office, which is one of the bedrooms in my home. My wife maintains an office on the other side of the hallway from me. She does all her business work there, and we deduct that from our income tax completely legally, completely above board. Like, I could do a screen capture video of my accountant doing the math and send it with my taxes to the IRS, and there is no foul. So I'm not talking about some kind of rigged game here. I'm saying just the way we structured everything. My house is a net producer today. And what I'm suggesting you do, I didn't do that overnight, right? The first step is to slow the bleeding then stop the bleeding and try to get par, and then try to flip that around to where the house is actually producing more values than it takes from you. And understand, you got to live somewhere. So right now, I could barely rent a two-bedroom apartment in a place that I would be willing to live for the total cost, including taxes on this place. And that takes time. I'm not bragging. That takes time to get to. And I know some people right now, especially young people, you know, you're thinking I'll never get there. Trust me, 22-year-old Jack Spirico, fresh out of the military here in Texas, working for $6 an hour, felt like you did. But then I decided, like, okay, I can either keep feeling that way, or I can figure out how to change it. And that's kind of the story that I just told you, the short version. But what we also should do is look back to the wisdom of our grandparents. And remember, you have more than just your grandparents, like your mom's dad and mom and your dad's mom and dad. You have great grandparents. So you got four grandparents, you got eight grandparents, you got 16 great great grandparents, and they're part of your lineage too. And most of you, if you go back far enough, even if you are recent to the country on one side of the family, there's probably somewhere in that family tree, some portion of your family's lineage probably does go back to the 18 or 17 or even 16 or earlier hundreds, right? And we need to think about what drove people to come here. If we go back prior to, let's say, World War I, that's not as far away as it seems, actually. It's 100 years, roughly, a little over 100 years. That's just a few generations, really, and you're back into that space. Up until about that time, there was still a lot of places in the world that a commoner couldn't own land. If we go back into the 1700s and pre-Civil War era, it was most of the world that commoners couldn't own land. Even if you could come up with the money, you legally could not actually own land. People were tenant farmers. And, you know, if you really want to get a feeling of what that was like, there's a great BBC series called Tudor Monetary Monastery Farm, Tudor Monastery Farm. And it's the same people that did, like, the one on Wartime Farm and Victorian Farm. But this is where they went way back. And I think, like, there was two guys and a chicken, that Ruth something. And she's there, and one of the dudes is in this newer one. And the other guy, I don't know, they didn't want to work with him anymore, whatever. Like, you get a really good understanding of that. So one of the chief drivers that made people come to this country, they wanted our freedom. Well, freedom to do what? One of the number one things people realize is, if I go to this place called America, I can own land. And so people, a lot of times people say they came here to get rich. But what did rich mean? I'm going to tell you right now, about 1790, being rich didn't mean what it meant today. Okay, you aren't looking at being a gajillionaire or whatever. If you owned a nice little 40-acre farm and a house you could raise a family in, and it was yours free and clear, you were rich. Now, there were people that had immense wealth beyond that. No, I mean, in your mind, when you were a poor day worker type situation, maybe you were even in and out of the poorhouse or something, and you were willing to work as hard as you could, but you just couldn't get ahead, and you saw somebody that had a nice little brick or stone or log cabin house and a little plot of land, and you know, maybe an ox or a pair of oxen or even a couple donkeys or something, and they were able to grow food for both their family and for market. And here's the big thing. They're able to take that and sell it and keep the farmer's share and the landowner's share. I mean, remember, you go back to this time in our country, and it's like 80%+ of people that lived here were either directly or secondarily employed in agriculture in some concept. So this was the main way people made a living at the time in much of the world, one way or another, connected to either food production or other products that we don't maybe think of as ag, but they kind of are, like timber and stuff like that. I mean, there was a huge shitstorm when the first sawmills were invented, because one of the big jobs you could have at the time, if you had a strong back and were willing to kill yourself, was being a sawman down in a pit making boards with a handsaw. And as bad as that job was, it was a good paying job for the time. People, so, like, this was just a different world. And so people came here and they had this idea that I can go to this place and I can, no matter how hard it is, and if I die and I've just got my fingers on it and I just accomplished it and I got it, but I got it done. We have the place. We have the homestead. And my family's born into this. My sons will do well. And so will my daughters. And their sons will do really well. That was the mindset that when they built a house, they were building it thinking about their grandchildren raising children in it someday. Now, this does not at all make any sense today to people. You know, like, think about a term we use today, a starter home. It's a starter home. And what that means is it's really not good enough to keep up with the Joneses. But we're younger than the Joneses, so we're going to buy the starter home and do enroll equity, kind of like I talked. There's nothing wrong with it, but it just wasn't what they did. They picked a place that they wanted to build their future and their family's future, and they put down roots. And I think that there is still a place for both. Like, there is a value to getting that starter home, but we should be working toward finding that permanent place. Especially when you start planting trees and bushes and stuff. I can't tell you how much it hurt me in some of my properties when we left and to look at a tree that was like a 10-year-old tree that I planted and go, I have to start all over again. And so a starter home for them was we built a little house. And since we built it ourselves, when there's another kid, we'll just build another room on. And of course, the other thing was they could, right? No, yeah, but I need to get a permit, right? Can you imagine one of Oklahoma, original Oklahoma Sooners, run in, grab their 40 acres, and then say, who do I ask for a permit to build my house? And after the house is built, well, I need a permit so we can add on. They're like, oh, shut up and go do it, Bill. Right? So there is a reason that it's not quite the way that it is anymore, and government plays a role, but our mindset is our own. We can choose how we come at this. The key shift is moving your home from consumer to producer. What can your home do for you? Can it house a business somehow? Can you put a garden in? Can you produce food? Can you raise small livestock? What can you do to make your house produce? Because as soon as your house starts producing, everything changes. Everything gets just a little bit better. We start this whole move from the liability to the asset side of the balance sheet. It's not a light switch, click on, click off. Like some people, I guess, maybe can hit a home run out of the gate and get it done that quick. What it tends to be is it's more like a dimmer switch for the light. And all the way off, the house is fully a liability. And as you begin to make these moves and changes in your life, you're slowly turning the lights up. And when the lights get nice and bright, you can see clearly in the room and you can see everything. That's when you've made the full switch. So you have to constantly be asking yourself, what does my home produce for me? And what does it take from me? And if it's taking from you, how can you stop the taking? And how can you increase the producing? You have to start out, again, by buying right, spending less than the bank says you have, and maybe a lot less. We bought our first house, 1998, $84,250. I think maybe that's why, like, my back hair, right? My back hair literally bristles like a dog when I see a Ford F1 freaking 50 with a sticker price on it of $78,000. That's $5,000 less than I paid for my first house. And it wasn't some dinky little shit house either. It was not, you know, it needed work. And that's something that, you know, we were willing to do going in, knowing that we would be better off for it. But it was 3-bedroom, huge bedrooms, big, beautiful kitchen, big, beautiful living room. When I say beautiful, I mean the floor plan. Like, everything was low end. Everything was builder grade and kind of worn a bit, but we just slowly redid things. And so when we sold the house not many years later, because I had that opportunity, took us to Pennsylvania, we made a really good profit. We rolled that into a house in Pennsylvania and we did that again. But when we bought the place in Pennsylvania, we found a house that had been on the market for 6 months. It had a lot of cosmetic problems. It just didn't show well. And it was a divorced couple in distress. They had all, like, the wife was still living there with the kids. and they had all the stuff in the house. And so it showed poorly because it was like they would just shove stuff against the wall and all the toys and games and crap. And so most people would look at it, they couldn't see what it would become, not even after you redid things, but just like, don't worry about this shit. It's not going to be here. It's not going to be here when you move in. So that gave us an opportunity, and we kept doing that. And that's how you have to start. And I know what people are going to say, well, Jack, interest rates are 7% now. And when I bought the house I just described to you, interest rates were 7%. And I remember 2 years later refinancing it down to like 4. And then a year and a half later selling it, and we took a bunch of money out of it again. We bought a house that was so much less than the one we sold. When we applied for the mortgage, I literally had to write a letter explaining we're not buying a less expensive house because we're in financial stress. We're buying a less expensive house because houses cost more in Pennsylvania than they do in Texas. It was just that simple. And so that's the kind of mindset. And I'm not saying do exactly what Jack did. I'm saying that's the mindset you have to go into it with. You need to find – what you should do is you should look up the book that I co-wrote with Dustin DeFriest. It's pretty cheap. It's on Amazon, How to Sell Your House Quick and at Asking in Any Market. And look at all the things that I tell you to do to sell a house. And the house you're looking to buy is the one where the people did none of those things. The foundation's not fucked. The roof isn't falling off or something like that. But it just doesn't freaking show well. And it's going to need things like carpet and paint. Like, to me, carpet, paint, flooring, countertops, I don't even care. I'm probably going to want to change it sooner or later anyway. So the fact that this looks like crap is good, I get a better deal. You also do need to accept something, though. I'm not this complete, like, all debt is sucky debt guy. If you are going to owe money on anything, real property is the place to owe money. And the reason I'll tell you, real property or a business, that you're running a line of credit against a business, and it's a well-run, growth-oriented business. Both of those do something that almost nothing else we finance does. And that's the underlying asset value goes up while the debt goes down. Even though it is a ridiculous thing in your head when you're thinking, I bought this house for $200,000, and if I take 30 years to pay for it, it's going to cost me $575,000 total out of pocket. Well, one of the problems people have with that is they're going to do the whole house payment, which includes, like, until you get over 20%, your PMI, your insurance, the house insurance itself, and your taxes, right? You really need to look at what is the cost of the house. And it will never be that – well, it might be that bad right now, but it's usually not quite that bad. So the other side is you can always accelerate your payments at some point in the future when it makes the most sense to do so. But the other side of it is, like, even with interest rates where they are now, look at buying a property. If I'm not worried about the payment, if I feel like I can service the debt no problem, even if I lost my business and had to go work for Walmart again or drive a truck or something, then I'm still okay with that number because I think I can do better than 6% on my money. And I'm sitting here with an interest payment. I feel like that meme with all the royals looking snootily down on people with like a less than 3% mortgage, right? Like, and that was like, there was no way I was going to come more equity heavy into this house with an interest rate that low. I figure if you can't do better than 3% return on your own money, you don't deserve the money. You hate money, and money will then therefore hate you. So that's just, again, how to think about this. But debt on real property or debt on any appreciating asset is the least bad of all debt. In the end, yes, you're technically still going to be better off if you pay it off. Every once in a while, we look at the balance on the house and go, should we throw like 10, 15 grand on this and see what happens and just keep accelerating? Because occasionally we do pay some extra on it, never that much, but we think about it at times. Because it will be nice when the only payments on this house is the insurance payment and the property tax. I hate the property tax, but I'll say this now for people that are special children. When you say, well, if you buy a house, you have to pay property taxes, so you never really own it. And if you rent a house from me, because real estate's another great investment when you're renting that property out, do you think that I pay your property taxes or do you think you pay mine? Like this whole, I'll tell you right now, these people that say this shit, that say this, and it's stupid. This is what my grandfather would tell you. You sound like a stupid fucking moron. That's what my grandfather Spearco would have said, right? Because he would have understood this intellectually as kind of primitive coal miner mindset as he had. He understood how freaking house worked and how taxes worked, right? And you're going to pay property tax if you're going to live on property, whether it's an apartment, a condo, it doesn't matter. When I set rent, there's two things I look at on a property, and I have rented property as a landlord, and as spreadsheet driven, what's the market? What can I get? And then I'm going to push it as high as I can, but the other side I'm going to look at is what? My cost. So before I would even buy a property that I intended on renting, then I want to know what I can get for it, and does the amount I can get for it exceed my cost? In other words, can I make the property cash flow positive? And if I can't, I'm not going to buy it. Well, do you think I'm going to leave property taxes off the freaking spreadsheet? I'm actually going to take the estimated property taxes and add 10% to them when I do that calculation. And so will any other landlord that doesn't go bankrupt. So tax sucks, but it is reality. It's a fact of life, and you can talk all your bullshit about allodial titles and whatever, and I'll see you when you're living on the street because they took your house away. We should all be at least partially homesteaders, in my opinion, and preppers specifically. The concept of being a prepper, let's take the overriding concept out of this for a second. Just think of being a prepper in of itself. Is that I want to be able to take care of myself if the systems of support that I currently rely on fail. Well, I can tell you that people don't think it's the case, but as soon as you get that storm and you can't go out, right? As soon as something shuts things down, as soon as there's a pandemic that isn't, but they turn it into one through policy, this just happened a few years ago, the first thing people start worrying about is food. And if you think back to just a few years ago, you could walk into a grocery store and you went to the produce section and it was wiped out. And you went to the meat cases and it was wiped out. And so everybody ran out initially and bought dried beans and pasta because the government said so. They came home and sat there and stared at it and went, well, this isn't what I really want. So then they went out and bought all the other shit. And then next thing you knew, you get all the dried beans and pasta and wheat berries you wanted, but you still were looking for produce and meat. As homesteaders, that's the primary foods that we can produce. We can produce eggs. We can produce meat. We can produce dairy if we go that route. We can produce as much produce as we want to eat. We can produce salad-level produce with an indoor farm of hydro or aquaponics. If you want to grow leafy greens, in my opinion, it's the way to go. It's the best, most efficient way to do it. So if we're worried about food storage on the hoof and food storage in the garden bed, that's kind of the way to go. We also are going to start thinking about other things as preppers, like backup energy and stuff like that. Well, that all fits in the homestead world. Being as self-sufficient as possible, right, and self-reliant as possible as well, is what homesteading's all about, and it's what prepping's all about. And you don't need, or perhaps even would not want, a lot of land. Everybody that gets in this mindset, I want 150 acres and all. And, you know, there's a piece of me that does too. And you know what I would want out of 150 acres? About 149 of it woods. I only need about an acre to do the things that I want to do. Now, you give me 150 acres I'm probably going to get my hands on an excavator and clear a few more than that 1 acre, but all that's going to be is ponds. The reality, though, is you can homestead, you know, half-acre homesteading. I did a whole series on it, is a thing, and most people can produce a ton of their own food and other needs on a half an acre or even a little bit less. It's amazing what you can do. If you really want to understand how much can be done with that, look at some of the work that Jeff Lawton's done, some of the bonus stuff from some of his DVDs where he's like in Vietnam and he's walking this food forest that's like been in the family for 300 years, and there's like this plant is edible and this is medicinal and this is there, and his great-grandfather planted this tree and all. And you know how much land it was? It was like 3/4 acre, and it was just outside of – it wasn't Saigon, but it was – or Hanoi or whatever. It was some fairly good-sized city, you know, something analogous to like a Savannah, Georgia or something like that in size. And this family had maintained this 3/4 acre food forest for 300 years. Those folks are homesteaders. And that is the mindset that we need to be thinking about. So how do we do that? What are the ways we can make this transition and change where we are and where we're going? One is grow food. That probably is the number one thing that you can do. And it's the number one thing that I took from my grandparents. Their view was pretty simple. We're going to eat every day. There's space there that can make food. We should be making food. Both of them thought that way. Now, my grandparents on my mom's side, my grandfather on that side, his family goes back to damn near North American settlements, German-Dutch. My grandmother's side on that side, she was actually the youngest daughter out of her sisters and brothers of like 11 children. And her next oldest sister were the only two that were actually born in this country. Their family came here, and then the mother had two more kids. They were Italian and came in through Ellis Island. And my great-grandfather on her side was a barber in New Jersey. And he raised a family of like 11 kids as a barber. And so there was New Jersey's the garden state, and they had a huge garden. So she was a big gardener. She was big into vegetables and all that, but also flowers and stuff. But they were all about, you just grew food. There was no livestock involved, and there wasn't any hunting. And my grandfather on that side took me fishing a lot when I was a kid. But he didn't do it because he only did it because his grandson wanted him to go fishing. It had no thing for him whatsoever. It was no big deal. My grandparents on the other side of the family would literally say, if you're going to go screw off today instead of do chores, go fishing and bring something home. Everybody got a hunting license at 12 years of age because that was the youngest you could get a hunting license in Pennsylvania. And everybody got one whether they hunted or not, because at the bottom of the license was a tag you could put on a deer. And a deer was a significant bump in the family's lifestyle for that year. So if you had a couple younger sisters who were never going to hunt, and if you might even have them sleeping on the first day of deer season in the truck and go, open, come on, honey, let's go. You just shot a deer. I was asleep. No, you shot a deer. And if the man asks, you shot a deer. And so back then it was one deer per license. So we did that all the time. We bought the license and then we shot the deer, and maybe the person that owned the license did. And I'm pretty sure statute of limitations on that one is up if there's any game wardens in PA that want to come after me for it. But we did that to live on. We used to have a saying about people, and it applied to us. People said it about us, and let's say that boy's smokehouse runs in June. And what that meant is you were still fishing and smoking trout in June. And so we weren't just homesteaders in what we could do with our land, but what was around us. We went out and foraged blackberries and blueberries and wild strawberries. Those were the three big berries that we would go out and forage. And blackberries and wild strawberries, most of the wild strawberries ended up eating. I foraged those myself and put them right in my mouth. Occasionally I'd bring home some for my grandma to do with, but they're itty bitty. Blackberries usually like me and maybe my uncle or me and my dad would go out and do that because that was easy. But blueberries, when they were in season, we would organize these like huge community things. There was this huge pole line that went up over one of the mountains by the water dam that was where all the water for the town came from. And you weren't even supposed to go there, but nobody was going to damn well stop anybody from going there. So we would get in Jeeps and shit and go up there, and we would have 30, 40 people picking blueberries and have that down to like people having jobs. So the trays like you get at a cafeteria or whatever, not the ones with division, just a big tray with a rim. We bring the berries back and you dump it into that tray. That way you could get them on one level and somebody would be sitting there picking all the green and reds that got in the mix out, and then dumping them into jugs, And then whatever amount we picked, each family would take an equal share home. So that side was about, like, not just what can we do with our land, not just can we do having a little chicken house. It was also like, hey, the squirrels are stealing the corn. Shoot the squirrel and we save the corn and eat the squirrel. And so sometimes when I'm talking, I realize that people that are new to the show, you don't know anything about who I was as like a teenager or a tweener or something. And you don't understand that where I'm coming from is a position of, we did all this not because it was cool. We did all this not because it was a hobby or something to do, or we thought it was fun. Now, we had a lot of fun hunting. We, you know, we had deer camp, and that was a lot of fun and all. But it was about putting food on the table. There wasn't a hunting season that we weren't involved with. What I mean by that is, you know, dove season came first. So we were dove hunting all the time. You shoot 12 doves a day. And I just will say that maybe sometimes you went out in the morning and you came home with 12 doves, and then you went out in the afternoon and maybe you came home with 12 more doves. And dove season was like the entire month of September, day after Labor Day forward. There's the stories people say, you know, we had gun racks in the back of the trucks in our high school parking lot and all. And I think a lot of those are a little bit exaggerated. I never saw a gun in a gun rack at a high school parking lot. That would have been, but there were a lot of people like me who did, you know, have a shotgun in a case behind the seat or in a trunk of a car at school. Because as soon as school was over, we went out to the dove fields. And I used to go hunting with my shop teacher, Mr. Fox, who when I would start my bullshit as a kid and be like, well, what if this and what if that? He was the guy that would say, yeah, he would have got fired today for it. If your aunt had balls, she'd be your uncle. And it wouldn't be because he said balls. It's because he gender assumed, right? Like, so I used to go hunting with him for doves all the time. But it was about, what did you bring home? I would go fishing all summer long. What did you bring home? What did you bring home? Now, generating income is another component to this. If you can build an income from your property, then you can never worry about losing it. If the house produces more income than it costs, you're golden. But most people are not going to come out of the gate. I've got a house that's a financial consumer, and I'm going to make one or two changes, and all of a sudden it's going to be a net positive. It's something that has to be done over time. And this starts really with the world of the side hustle. Now, we didn't call it a side hustle, you know, back in my grandparents' days, right, in my parents' days. But not just them, but everybody I knew had side hustles. Like, one of the things that was a side hustle that I never even thought of as a side hustle was my one uncle and I were really good mushroom hunters. We spent so much time fishing and hunting that we spent so much time in so many different diversity of woodlands. And what I was saying earlier about every hunting season, so there was, you know, there was dove season, and then there was small game, which was like rabbit and grouse and pheasant, and there was deer season, right? And there was also squirrels. And, you know, I ran trap lines, and we took food from that as well. Like, you didn't throw away good meat. We didn't skin a raccoon and throw the carcass out. Raccoon meat's pretty good. So we had all this that coming in, but because of that, we also were able to find mushrooms. And there's a mushroom that even back then was highly desired and very expensive called the maitake, or the hen of the woods, also known where I was from, everybody called them ram's head mushrooms. They're huge. And we had gotten, and they will grow in the same place at the base of an oak tree once you know where they are every year. And we had all kinds of little areas that we knew about. And there were times we came home with like the whole bed of his Jeep filled to the top with ram's heads. No matter how much you love mushrooms, you can only do so much with them. People paid 10 bucks a pound for them. We would come home like that and drive around with a scale and go in all those little bar rooms I was talking about yesterday. How many do you want? And people buy 2 pounds, 20 bucks. 20 bucks in the 1980s, folks, could do a little bit for you. I remember I told you yesterday, you get a beer at Lazarus for 50 cents. So that's 40 beers for 2 pounds of mushrooms we just cut off the ground. That was the side hustle. My uncle tied flies. and he would sell his flies. I reloaded ammunition. I got into that very young, and I got into it for us so we could shoot more and pay less. But then all of a sudden, I was selling ammo to all of his friends. Like, they wanted hotter loads or whatever, and I would just, you know, here's how much the box is. And so some of this is, like, homestead-related, and some of it's just mindset. My first actual business that I ever had that had, like, an ongoing recurrent income coming in, it wasn't passive, though. Back in the 80s, if you wanted a new album, where did you go when the new, like, Def Leppard album came out, right? Or the new Iron Maiden album or whatever came out. You went to, I know this is crazy, but you went to a place they called a record store. Now, by then, there was hardly any records at the record store. They were cassette tapes. And all of a sudden, these things came out, and they had two cassette decks in it, and everybody wanted one. And real quick, I snapped to, I can make tapes with this. And I would go out and buy a big bulk pack of Memorex tapes. I had a literal catalog when I was in high school. And I had classmates that would look through that catalog, and they would order either whole albums or they would order, like, mixtapes. And I would go home and make them. And albums were the best. You get a new album, everybody wants a copy. And it's like, they're expensive even then. It was like $12 for a freaking album, you know, but you could sell them for $5. So you go buy it, and once you had high speed dubbing, you could just bang them out, right? And so I was always looking for ways to bring money in. And this is how you have to start thinking today. Hoax asks, was ginseng popular back then? There was money in it, but there wasn't a lot around where we grew up. That wasn't a thing. But we would, you know, we did some kind of, like, at times informal fishing guiding. We never did it with hunting. The hunting, the meat was so valuable to us that the idea that we would take somebody else hunting for money didn't really work out. And everybody up there either knew how to hunt or couldn't hunt. But there were people that would be like, well, I want to go fishing. And we'd say, you know, like, well, we'll take you for $50. So we did that, too. There was always ways to do this. Yes, pirating music, you bet. I pirated the hell out of that. Anyone can golf says morals. We didn't have a lot of morals. Occasionally we'd find a few. Chanterelles were also a big score. But we never really found enough of those that we wanted to sell them. It was the ram's heads that we sold like crazy, because we had gotten to where we knew where so many of them were, and they were so easy. And you cut one, and you've got like a 4-pound mushroom. It's all these like little ears. If you've never seen one, look them up. But like these are like back then, people wanted them because they wanted them, and they didn't know where they were. They were too lazy to go get them, and they were willing to pay a little bit every year to get some. Today, you go to like top end restaurants, and you know, you go to a plate where they're doing like a $60 meal plate. Chef Tim Love's place, Lonesome Dove. In Fort Worth, they do this one meal. It's actually modeled on a Finnish meal that's made with lingonberries and reindeer loin, but it's like the North American version that Tim came up with, and it's like elk loin and candied grapes in for the lingonberries, and they use chanterelles in their version, and he uses maitakes. So he's using maitakes at a restaurant. If you go in there with four people, you're dropping $400 or $500, and we were just picking them up off the ground. And yet, I guarantee you, they still grow in those places. I've talked about hustling scrap copper, picking up coal lumps. We used to drive around with a pickup truck up by the old mines, and we would find lumps of coal. And you load it, you know, you take a while. Maybe you're out 3 or 4 times before you load the back of the truck up with, like, a ton of coal. $90. Go to the breaker, unload it, $90. Just for basically throwing – now, that didn't last. Eventually, when everybody caught on to it, pretty much most of the stuff that could just be picked up as mine slag got picked up. But we were always thinking, what can we do to earn some more money? And not, well, I don't want to work today because I worked yesterday. It was that opportunity. I'm going to hit that. And so you have to start looking at your home and think, what are the ways that I can increase my income that my home can enable me to do that? If you have enough land, you know, putting in a couple tiny houses and renting them out on Airbnb would be another example. I've talked to a few people in this audience, you know, they have 10, 12 acres. They have a little pond on the back. They put 3 or 4 tiny houses, and all of a sudden they're living mortgage-free for the rest of their life, even though they have a mortgage. They literally have a net positive income just from that. It's all about what you can make of it. Provide recreation is another thing, though. You know, having fun has gotten to be expensive, hasn't it? You know, what I miss about my place I owned in Arkansas, what I miss about the place I grew up with, my grandparents' place in Pennsylvania, was being able to go out in my backyard and shoot. Legally, I can do it here. Morally and ethically, I don't consider it safe based on where places are around me. But I think back to, like, you know, even just going to a gun range, even just a regular public range that you just pay a day fee for, can be kind of expensive. There was one indoor range at a gun store near me where I grew up as a kid, and they barely got by because nobody wanted to pay to go to the gun range. They just go out to the hills somewhere and shoot, and I missed that. So we had a skeet range in my backyard. That's one of the reasons I am what I am with a shotgun, because I could go out any day I wanted and shoot 25 rounds of skeet, no problem. I needed enough money to buy a box of shells, and once I start reloading, that was half the cost, right? We even used to build these things to improve your kind of, we called it pop shooting, when that bird gets up real quick and you got to pop it because he's going back down underneath something. Like grouse will do that, quail will do that. We would take pipe, and we would put them on a board, and they would all be on different angles, and we'd take a mattress spring, and you always could find mattresses laying around the stripping holes where people couldn't get rid of them at the dump, so they just threw them out there. Pull the spring out, you put mount the spring to the board, and you've got like five, it almost looks like a mortar thing, and you make a pin, and you push the can down with a stick, and you make a hole in the pipe and stick the pin through it. And you could put several holes, so if you put the hole pretty far down, the can would go pretty high up. And if you put the pin higher, then the can would have less time to take a shot at. So we would build those, and then we would make like five lines, but only load four pipes. So when you said pull, you never knew which one the other person was going to pull. So you had to visual, you know, acuity, and this came up, and now I got to make the shot. We turned it into recreation. We turned it into fun. And so if you're spending time with recreation and not money, then you're not spending that time spending money for your recreation. So you have to start thinking, what can my property do as an entertainment venue for me? You know, we hate the summers here to a degree because it's so hot. We spend most of our time inside. This last week, this weather has flipped. It was 58 degrees yesterday morning. I think it was 62 this morning. As soon as I got done with the show yesterday, I had a bunch of work to do to get ready for the workshop, but all computer work, and to finish up the final exam for the course we're going to be releasing, hopefully this week, on cover cropping. I sat out on the back porch and entertainment. I got geese, I got chickens, I got ducks, I got my grandkids running around. I don't need much more than that to be entertained. So how can we make the property entertain us, feed us, and put money in our pocket? And then one thing you can do once you have a house, it's really hard to do an apartment, is you can do things like add that second or third deep freezer, right? You can have more space to store more food. Well, what happens once that becomes the case? Well, when there's a huge windfall available because it's seasonal, like a bunch of mushrooms, and you can the ones you don't sell, you have a place to put them. Or when you go to Costco Business Center, you can buy a couple whole chuck rolls, come home, cut all that meat, and wrap it up in a vac sealer and freeze it and have room for it. Most people in apartments, what do they have? That little tiny freezer section. How much meat can you really have on hand that way? So economy of scale is something that owning a home turns you onto. But if you're house poor, you can't afford the scale of the economy. But if you buy smart, now I can use the space, and all of a sudden I can go out and do these larger scale buys. And I have, you know, I have ways that I can scale everything that I'm doing. I can go down to the farmer's market toward the end of the season and walk by a place and see like this dude with boxes of green beans sitting there just miserable because no one's buying any green beans because everybody has them, and go, how much you want for all of them? What? How much you look miserable. This looks like mostly what you have. There's like three crates of them there. How much do you want for all of them? Cash money right now. And the guy says, well, I'm like $70. Here, boom, gone. Right? I have a place I can process and store all of that if I'm not growing them myself. Economy of scale is a huge advantage. Another thing is learning to do what I just said, which is convert food into storable items. I don't know about you. I enjoy things like making sausage. Right now, it's pushing me to my limit because I'm making 25-pound batches. I generally make about a 10-pound batch when I make a batch of sausage for personal use. I'm making 25-pound batches, three batches, so I can do three servings at one workshop and feed 70-odd people. I don't want to do this every day of my life. I don't want to do it every day of my life. I want to be able to do enough in one processing to be like, okay, that's done for the year, or that's done for the quarter or half the year. You know, when you get into deer season, you bring a few deer home, you make a few batches of biltong, and you're done making biltong out of venison for the season. You go out in the spring and you catch a whole bunch of catfish, and you bring them home and you smoke them, and you vac seal them, and you put them in the freezer, and you're kind of done with that for a while. That's the approach that I want to take. And when you have a homestead and you set yourself up for this, you can batch larger volumes at a time and not like be doing this work all the time. People look at what you do when you get into this lifestyle and they think, well, all you do is work. But I believe you actually work less. And Hoags is saying, you know, just like canning once a year. Exactly, because what's more work? Go out to the garden, pick the green beans, cut the green beans up, fry the green beans, throw some bacon in them, or open the can with the green beans in it, dump them in the pan, warm them up, and throw some bacon on them. Well, the second one's less work. The majority of the work is done in a batch, and then we can just pull from the pantry and eat convenience style, like people who go to the grocery store and buy all the garbage off the shelves of the grocery store, except we know what's in our food. Even if you're buying the food from the grocery store, you're buying whole ingredients now. You know, now we know exactly what we're eating. The list of ingredients isn't 17 long. It's, you know, 1, 2, 3, or 4. Maybe with sausage it might be 12, but they're all things like herbs and seasonings and stuff like that. And then energy efficiency or production is a huge thing as well. And right now it's sickening what's happened. Our electric bill is almost double what it was 3 months ago because our contract ran out. And thank you, Cackles and Brandon, for fucking up the energy economy of the United States. And, you know, even competitive markets like Texas that are less expensive, our rates on electricity, the rates themselves have pretty much doubled over the last 3 years. And now we're stuck with at least a year of that shit. But most people think, well, solar panels and windmills and micro hydro, and that's all wonderful. But where's the first place you should start? Efficiency. You know, what's the low-hanging fruit? More insulation in the attic, better windows, whatever. Anything that reduces the outflow of money reduces the concept of a liability on the home, right? So start with efficiency and then look at things like solar, et cetera, backup power and other forms like generators and all, so you don't lose that investment. You know, all the freezers that we were just talking about, you better have a generator sufficient to run all that shit and enough gas to run that shit for about a month. Because the last thing you want is to lose it during a long-term outage. Fortunately for us, most of our longer-term outages down here are in the winter. And it's really cold, and that's why the power went out. So we're not too worried about keeping food cold in that situation, right? And then learn to locally forage. I kind of hit that when I was talking about growing and saving food. But there's probably food right out your door. Rob Greenfield, who had the show long ago, he did the one-year project where he basically built this little tiny house for a few hundred bucks in somebody's backyard, started growing his own food, and he lived for a year 100% off of land. And, you know, he picked a pretty good place. Florida's a pretty good place to pull that off. And his tiny house was more tent than house in some ways. He just did a thing where he went 2 weeks all foraged food. If he can do that, then what can we do? And I think this is one of the most overlooked things that there is what is just sitting there that the only thing you lack in being able to partake in it is a little bit of knowledge. And I think it makes a lot of sense if you, like, I just don't, Jack, it's fine that you said that. You just explained how you grew up. Great for you. That's fine. I did. I don't know any of this shit. My dad doesn't know any of this shit. My kids don't know any of this shit. I live in this place. I bet you somewhere around you there is someone that is a local foraging expert that you could hire to take you out. And I would say have them take you out in spring, summer, and fall. Because those are your three big seasons. There's not a lot of foraging in most places anyway in the wintertime. When we used to grouse hunt, especially second season, you're into like after Christmas on that second season small game, second season deer hunting. Then you get out there and there's some snow on the ground and all. About the only thing that you would find along the way that could be a little snack was a thing called a tea berry. And a tea berry is the berry on a wintergreen plant. That was winter green. It grows green in winter and it has these little pinkish reddish berries and they're white inside and they taste like a little bit of fruit and mostly wintergreen, just like wintergreen gum. That was about it. The rest of the year, there was always something. Fiddlehead ferns in the spring, right? Ramps in the spring, things like that. Most of your berries were in the spring. Through the summer, you got into, like, the blackberries were more a early summer than spring crop. There was always something out there that you could find. You started to move into some of the mushrooms in summer, and then in early fall into late fall, that's where you got, you know, the chanterelles and the ram's heads and the spongies and stuff like that. So I'm guaranteeing you there was more there than I knew, but we knew enough to bring it in and to have a significant impact on, you know, we didn't have much of a grocery bill. The shit we bought at the grocery store was like coffee, salt. I mean, like, we did buy some beef because we've always been beef eaters and we like steak. And, you know, we bought some chicken because most of our chickens were just old layers and stuff like that that weren't great meat birds. But mostly what we ate, we either hunted, we fished, or we foraged, or we grew. And we, again, people today get into this mindset that I have to spend thousands of dollars to put a garden in. No, you don't. I mean, the only reason I really do raised beds, guys, is because it's convenient and I can't do it any other way here. My grandfather didn't ever do a raised bed. I never saw a raised bed until I moved to Texas. And I real quick understood why people here did it. Real quick. My grandfather said, what are you doing? There's dirt there. Dig it up and plant into it, right? So we did all this as very economically repressed people. I tend to not want to use the word poor, not because I'm embarrassed of my family or my upbringing at all, because I never felt that way. Now, looking back at it, I can say our income levels were below the poverty line, and almost everybody that I went to school with, their income levels were below the poverty line, including, you know, people with decent jobs for the area. We just didn't pay well to live there. It just didn't. But I never felt poor. How could I feel poor? I'm sitting here eating freaking rabbit and venison loin with ram's head mushrooms with blackberry sauce. That's not what poor people eat. But yes, it is. Yes, it is. So you tell somebody you're eating squirrel, they think of that as being poor, and they probably ain't never had it before. I make you a squirrel, you'll be buying, if you don't live in a place where you can fire a 22, you'll be buying a gammo the next day if I cook you a piece of squirrel meat, right? Like, this is just not that far away. I know when I talk like that about this, there's probably people who have never tuned in to see the video version of this show because like 95% don't, are thinking, this dude must be like well-spoken for it, but he must be like 88 years old or something. I'm 52 years old. The time I'm talking about is about from about 1978 to about 1990. That frame of time is where all this was going on. And it certainly went on before that. I was there, but I don't remember it. I was crapping my pants or running around with Pepsi in a baby bottle or something. Like, I don't really remember much before about 78, maybe 76-ish. I got some of my earliest memories of like first day at kindergarten and shit like that. But my teen years, it was mid-80s, straight through the mid-80s, left for the Army in 1989. So this is not so far away that we can't recapture it. anybody that wants to live this way today can. I have a friend named Brad, and he's one of the most negative people in the world. And it's always saddened me that he was that way, because he was a very gifted person in so many ways, and he was a good-looking guy. Always had women bouncing off of him and everything. Now he's way overweight, but he just got married for the third time, so maybe that'll work out. I hope it does. But he used to talk about this stuff, and he grew up like me, except he grew up instead of in Pennsylvania. He grew up in, like, South Louisiana. And he would tell me, I want to live this way, but I can't afford to. And I'm like, every person you know that lives this way today is a broke-ass redneck in South Louisiana. If you want to live that way, go do it. He'd go, oh, you got a point. And then he'd come up with 10 reasons he couldn't. And that's what you have to not do. You can't convince yourself that this is so far gone that it can't be recaptured or can't done. There's people doing it right now. I'm doing it right now. A lot of you guys are doing it right now. In the end, it's really more about how you think than what you do. If you think the right way, what you do might be different than what I do, and it might be different than what Bonnie Blue does, or Mama Bear does here, or Usarian does, I mean, Tom does, or Curtis does. I'm just reading names out of the chat right now. It might be different. All of you might do it a little bit differently, but the net result is what's the same. The net result is I'm taking this house that I spend, you know, 60 to 70 hours a week not in to pay for. You know, I refer to cars as mobile metal coffins. I wrote back in when I was a really young man, I thought it was cool. I used to write poems, and I wrote a poem. I can't remember exactly what it was called or exactly what was in it, but it was the line was something to the effect of mobile metal coffins going to and fro, carrying these people wherever they must go. And it was, you know, even then I was looking ahead and realizing I was going to have to do some of that shit to get what I wanted. But I didn't really want to. I wanted where I'm at now. And that mindset is so freaking important. And that's what happens. We're spending, you know, a lot of people spend 3 hours a day just going to and from work and all the other little side errands that they have to do. You spend 3 hours a day in your car. If you don't use your car for work other than like going there and coming back, some people spend all day in their car working or half the day in their car driving around for work. And then you come home, and if you're like most people today, once you have kids, well, they got to be in activity. So each kid's in 3 or 4 activities. My son's in this trap right now. He's done it to himself. And so they're never home, and they spend like a huge block, 25 to 35% of their life force in the form of their income to pay for a box that mostly all they do is sleep in. And so as long as you're in that mindset, you're going to maintain that as a liability because it's just the thing I have to have. It's not really a home. I say from home to homestead. I did that because I'm a marketer and it sounds good. It resonates when you say from home to homestead. It's really from house to homestead or from house to home. I didn't do house to home because everybody thinks of that as you put some pictures up and you make it feel nice. That's not what I mean. I mean, it goes from this hole that money flows into to this wonderful thing that everything springs from. My food, my business, the growth of my children. That's what makes a house a home. It's not that you decorated it because and you bought shit that Joanna Gaines made or something like that. You put shiplap on the fucking walls. Now it's a home. No, bullshit. What you do with it, and you know what a home is? It's where you live. It's where you live. How many people don't fucking live in their house? How do you know if you live in your house? Where do you spend most of your time? Wherever you spend most of your time is where you live. Most people do not spend most of their time in their house. If we took out the sleeping period, almost nobody does anymore. I used to think my grandfather, like, yo, man, how is he so happy sitting on his porch? Just sitting on his porch. Well, I think back now, and it makes perfect sense that he was happy. He had raised his 3 sons. He would go into town and see his friends. He'd come home, and our house that we had It was kind of like the front porch looked down the main road, like the road went past the side of the house, so you're looking down the road. So I mean, it came up that road walking, and lots of people still walked at the time, right? And so anybody that came up that road knew him and would talk to him and say hi, maybe come by and visit for a few minutes before they head up. If they're coming down, they might come in and do that as well. But he'd see also all his friends, even if they didn't stop, come by in the car and blow the horn and wave. I was always there hanging out. He didn't have to really take care of the garden anymore. Go down there and weed out the tomatoes today. There's weeds everywhere. That's the only one that really needs it today, you know. And I'd go take care of that for him. And then he'd see all that stuff come up out of the garden and know that's all going in the deep freezer, canned down in the cellar, and it's all going to be good. And just pulled all the onions heading into September, and me and the uncle are fixing to go dove hunting and bring doves home. And, like, why wouldn't he have been happy? He had the old bird dog would hang out with him, and, you know, his house had been paid for since the fucking 50s. Since the 50s, he had that house paid off. And I think back now and go, and he'd listen to his shitty polka music on AM radio on Sundays and all. And I would think, how can he be so happy doing nothing? And now I saw this old lady on Instagram or something, and she was like this old Greek lady, and the daughter invited her to a barbecue that night or something. And she was like, let me tell you, do not ask me in the last minute to do anything, because I very much enjoy doing nothing. And if my plans to do nothing are going to be interrupted, I need a lot of advance notice, right? And I'm like, I identify with this. I still want to do more stuff than I guess she did. She was pretty heavy. And I want to do more stuff than my grandfather did. But I totally get sitting on the porch with the dog, having a beer, watching my grandkids run around and go, what else could I really ask for? And I think if we had these conversations with people when they were young, and not necessarily kids, but like teenager 20-somethings, about this vision of what you can build, maybe we'd stop thinking in this mindset of flipping up in housing and start thinking, how do I get to where I really want to be? Where do I want to be when I change into that chapter in my life? Where my home is really where my heart is. Instead of I'm going to move off to Florida to some senior community where everybody picks up my garbage for me. Like we have turned, because we have turned away from this, we've turned away from the multi-generational family. We don't have that anymore. You know, the grandkids don't come around anymore. Everybody grows up and moves away. And I understand that. I did. You may have to. But it doesn't mean that when you become that nomad, you can't eventually put down roots and build something like this for yourself because, and this is another topic we did a lot, and we'll probably do it again in the next week or two, homesteading is a retirement plan. When you do all of this right, you end up in a position like my grandfather was in. Like, there's no way he would have sold that place. Hell, my dad still lives in it to drive it home for real. And that house was built in the 1800s. But, like, he would have never sold his house because where would he have moved to? He could have never actually got in a better situation economically than he already was in. Even 30 years, if you can get into a home by the time you're 25, and I know you're going to tell me you can't, but somebody's going to do it tomorrow, right? And it's not going to be some kid on TikTok with a Lamborghini. Some regular, everyday, blue-collar kid tomorrow morning is going to move into his first house. And if you can move into the right house that you can do with this at 25, even a 30-year mortgage, right? They're about 55 years old, house paid for. You got a lot of living left to do, especially if you're living this way, healthy, in the right way, and you can always accelerate those payments, like I said. Even a 30-year-old that buys their first house, if it's their long-term home, by 60, they don't have a house payment anymore. Most people aren't even retired yet. But how many people do it anymore? Yeah, Hoke says no more family reunions. Yeah, that used to be a big thing, didn't it? Right? Like even when if you moved away, you still had kind of like at least every 5 years or something, the whole family gets together. Hell, Thanksgiving was a family reunion for most people, you know, at least every other year. Like you went to one side of the in-laws and the other side, something like that, or one got Thanksgiving, one got Christmas. So much of that's gone. But it's not because we don't value family. It's because we don't value the home anymore. And again, you know, I talked about how people came here originally because you could own land and you could make it produce and you could keep the production for yourself instead of giving a portion to the lord or the duke or the king. You were the lord of your land. You were the king of your homestead. And even today, you know, they'll tax your property, but they'll tax my neighbor with 3 acres across the street and a house about the size of mine, about the same amount of money that I pay. He's paying the same property tax right over there that I am right here. He doesn't have a business. He doesn't have a garden. He doesn't have livestock. So I pay no tax on the eggs that are so valuable that people will pay me 12 bucks for them. I can eat them anytime I want. 12 bucks a dozen, I can eat that whenever I want, no cost. The value of my garden production, the meat we produce, all of it. Like, that's all part of what comes out of it. And I get to keep all that. They can't tax that. They ain't figured it out yet. I'm sure someday they'll figure out, like, well, you take, you know, X number of breaths a minute, and here's your air tax. I'm sure they'll try that at some point. They've already talked about taxing, like, how much sun lands on your property or some shit. But, I mean, as of right now, whatever I grow, whatever I produce, I keep. And whatever I do to my land that increases its value, I have that equity, but they can't tax it because they don't understand it. Now, if I ever go to sell the property, I'll get something for that equity. And I'll pay tax on the gain, sort of, because at my pay grade, I'm not going to pay hardly anything. My wife and I can make $500,000 every 3 years on real estate. That's how our tax works out, without paying any income tax on it at all. Every 3 years, you can sell one house, $250,000 gained per taxpayer. So for a married couple, that's $500,000. We ain't gonna make quite a bit. We ain't gonna make $500,000 profit off of the house. So that gain, the trees, the systems, all the stuff we've built, all the infrastructure we put in, it's not part of our property tax bill. And if we sell it and harvest that equity at some point because we do decide we want something else, we'll never pay any tax on it at all. We have been able to create things that we have value in that they can't take a piece of, is what I'm saying. And what I want you to really understand is that the spirit that drove your ancestors, your grandparents, which may be your great or great great or great 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 grandparents, to come here, lives in you, is still alive. It's not gone. I know we talked yesterday about how crazy the world has gotten, and it has, how the denominator has been dropped, but people aren't actually dumber. They're improperly educated is what they are. They're worse than dumb. At least, you know, stupid people know they're stupid, and they know because they know they're stupid, they know not to make their decisions for themselves and ask somebody else for help, right? Dumb people generally know that they're dumb. Intelligent people that are miseducated, they mistake themselves as being very, very intelligent, even though they're doing dumb shit. And that's why they're a lot more self-destructive. You know, when you got, I guarantee everybody out there knows somebody, you're like, bro is not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but he's a nice guy and he knows he's not the smartest man on the planet. So he's all right. But then think about most of these people that sound so stupid, but they think you're the dumb one. They think you're the idiot. The person who mocks the guy that went out and got an electrical journeyman's license, you know, and did his apprenticeship and all, and, you know, he's knocking $80,000, $90,000 back a year, but they have a PhD in some bullshit literature genre or something, and they'll mock him. Well, he's the guy that climbs up on the pole and turns their fucking electricity off, isn't he? Right? I mean, but this is not because that person with the degree in French literature is actually stupid. It's because they do not have an understanding of what priorities for life really are supposed to be all about. They think other people are supposed to provide them to you, and the more initials and letters you have after your name, the more that you're owed. Or the less than the more. See, everybody deserves more all the time. They've destroyed the concept of meritocracy. But it's fake. It's not real. There's nothing about it that's real. This is not the true human condition. This is something that we've been lulled into belief in. We've become comfortable with because we've been able to cheat the system humanity developed in. If we go back just 150 years, you do not have a light switch that puts lights on in your home. You do not have a magic box that you can cut up a cow into pieces and stick it in there and keep it for a year perfectly fine, and all you had to do is stick it in there and close the door. You do not have a stove that you just turn on and cook, right? You're going to your fireplace and you're making a fire and you're pulling coals to the side and that's how you're cooking. You're not going to the store and buying pre-sliced Wonder Bread. You're taking raw materials. Somebody's needing that shit, right? This is why most people worked in agriculture, because the most important thing was eating. And it took that much effort to produce enough food for everybody to have food. When we figured out how to split the atom and refine oil and pump natural gas and build machinery and equipment to do everything, it was a wonderful advance for humanity. But it also was a cheat. It was a cheat. And we went from having a society full of slaves and serfs and poverty-stricken people to having machines as our slaves. And we still do today. We certainly have machines as our slaves. I'm not saying it's bad, but it's made us lose touch with what the human condition really is. The human condition is one of survival of the fittest. If you weren't able to take care of yourself a couple hundred years ago, you just died. Or you had to have been so much valuable to somebody that somebody in that same position that had to fight to survive was willing to provide for you. You know, if you were an old man and you did a good job raising your kids, they would probably look after you in your old age. Now we don't even do that anymore. We send dad off or mom off to the home and we comfort ourselves with pictures of them playing backgammon or parcheesi and think their life's pretty good. And we see them once a month or, you know, who knows how infrequently, and say it's all good. We've separated ourselves from that human condition and we've lost our grandparents' wisdom. Your grandparents and your great grandparents were probably less informed about the world and less intelligent if you judge them on a science exam or a mathematics exam. Maybe not, right? If you look at what an eighth grade final exam for mathematics was in 1900, you might be surprised. But in general, a lot of people never made it through eighth grade, right? So they were less knowledgeable about some things than you are today. You're knowledgeable about things they couldn't have been knowledgeable about because they couldn't exist. You know how to use a MacBook or a PC? Well, they couldn't know that. It didn't exist. But when it came to knowledge of how to live and how to survive, they were so much more intelligent than we are today. And the thing that drove them to come here is still inside all of us today because we're the same people. A few questions really quick here. Hogs says, do you wait or look to buy now on property? You wait until you find what you're looking for, and you look all the time. Shopping for real estate is free. If you do not own a piece of property and you want a piece of property, you should be looking online constantly, and anything that's close enough for you to drive by and look at it and ascertain it, you should be doing, because then you won't be like, oh man, this is a good deal, when it's not. You'll know a good deal when you see it just by becoming a professional real estate shopper, like window shopper, right? Literally window shopper. There's no real estate agent. I'm looking the window. Hopefully nobody's going to get mad, right? Like the signs are for sale. It doesn't look like anybody's home. I'm going to at least see what it looks like inside, right? So I think you should be looking. You should always be trying to buy if you need to get into a home, but you shouldn't be desperate to buy. Desperate leads to dumb decisions. Let me say it again. Desperation leads to dumb decisions. So be looking to buy now, but do not feel so compelled to buy that you buy something that you shouldn't buy. I hope that makes sense. Curtis says, we've been building up our farmstead for 12 years, still some to go, but we also have a medium-scale commercial farm, grain, cattle, pasture, pigs, that we operate on a shoestring. Okay, that's not a question, but he's got two-part. What are your thoughts on investing more in better used equipment, buying more land to expand with stacked enterprises, grain, cattle, bees, and specialty grains. I think the stacking of enterprises is a really good thing. I think before you buy more land, now, the thing about this is a lot of times you own land, like land that's adjacent becomes available, and if you want to expand continuous land, you kind of have to take that opportunity when it comes up. And so you might have to accelerate that in that situation. But how much are you getting the full utilization out of your property? Joel Salatin has a video. I'll see if I can find it when I'm done recording here. But he talks about how to take basically 20 acres and make it into 80 acres without actually owning any more land by the way the infrastructure is set up for cattle on it, and doing things like one stock tank is at this place, and it's where your fence crosses, and a quarter of that stock tank is a big round one, and so a quarter of that stock tank is available from each of those four paddocks. Just one example of what he's talking about. And then that stock tank has a water supply to it with a float valve. So now I got one stock tank handling four paddocks. That's just one. And I would look at, like, are you really getting the full value out of what you already have? Because let's say I can buy another 10 acres. And that 10 acres, I get a decent deal on it, $10,000 or $100,000. And that $100,000 worth of land nets me another $20,000 a year in income. Well, you know, 5 years, the land's kind of paid for, and I have the underlying value of land. But what if I could just make another $20,000 on the land that I already have with no additional outflow of income? There's a lot of ways in which that would be a much better financial thing. And once you start thinking that way, you might realize that before I buy anything else, I've got this laundry list that I can do of what I have. But if you can legitimately buy more land and rapidly make it pay for itself, it's probably worth doing. Now, in the agricultural space, the most successful farmers I know own relatively little land compared to the land that they manage. So Greg Judy is managing something like 25,000 acres of land. He might be smaller than that now because I know as he's gotten older, he scaled back. He got rid of all the cows. He does 100% sheep now. But it's still thousands of acres that he's managing. He owns like 40 or 70 acres that he lives on, and he has like another couple hundred. And the other couple hundred that he actually owns is near his house. But he leased that land like for decades, and the dude that owned it decided that his kids were not going to ever care about it and take care of it. So when he died, he left a lot of money to his kids, but he left his land to he left them like the house and like an acre, and the rest of the land he left it to Greg. And Greg is not in a hurry to buy more land. I don't think he ever will. So if I'm leasing land and it's profitable, then I never have to worry about losing the land I own, because I have a cash flow from land I don't even have a real obligation to. In fact, that cash, well, you've got to pay the lease fee, but if I'm not going to make more off the land than the lease fee, I'm not going to lease it. And I could always, at the end of those leases, just walk away from that land and I still have what I have, right? So I would think that way, too, a bit. John Hendricks says, Jack, we've been listening to you for over 12 years now. You've inspired me and my family, and I so much. We're debt-free and have a hurricane coming at us right now. More prepared and not stressed. Not really a question, but that's a great comment. Those are the kind of comments, guys, that, man, I love getting. I got a bunch of emails in the last couple of weeks that are like that, or we started a business, or, you know, this thing happened, or, you know, one guy wrote me, I'm walking through my, on my phone doing this email, and I'm eating apples off my tree and shit. Like, man, I love getting emails like that, and that's why I do this show. Hope you guys enjoyed today's show. Remember, one way you can support us is do your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Same item of the day as yesterday. It is starting to get colder out. It ain't cold yet, but it's going to be. You need a backup source of heat. The Mr. Heater Portable Big Buddy Propane Heater is the item of the day. You can find that at T-Spaz in the write-up. That's all I'll say about it so I can get done here and signed off. Again, reminder, I do have out. You can go right now to the survivalpodcast.com. If you're listening to it after the audio is published, you might have to scroll one or two posts down If you're listening live and you go there right now, you just be the first post at the top of the page. TSP 24 will be epic. Everything you need to know, all the details. But the big thing to know is the day that the tickets are going on sale. These tickets are going on sale September the 21st, 9 a.m. Central Time. There's no close in this, right? It's not hand grenades and it's not horseshoes. Close is a miss, right? I say this every year. I think people think it's marketing sometimes, and then I get the angry emails. Well, I was there at 10 after, and all the tickets were sold. Well, that happens. That sells out fast. Last year was something like 2.5 minutes. 2.5 minutes, and it was sold out. This year could be an hour, but it's not going to be a day. So if you want to get a ticket, what you need to do, and it's right in the list, you need to get on the Telegram channel or the group. Either one will work. But at 9 a.m. on Saturday the 21st, I'm going to drop a link in the Telegram channel, and it will go also to the group. At that point, it's a race, like the movie Rat Race, right? It's a race. I am winning. And you, I'm going to tell you, I feel bad every freaking year. I hear from people who I know on a first name basis, they're friends, you know, they've been around a long time and they want to come be part of this, but they didn't get a ticket. And it sucks, but I have a headcount limit. I just can't do more. We've actually expanded the total number for a couple of years, and it wasn't a good decision. That's why we brought it back down. Do we sell 50 tickets? They sell out in minutes. So please do not forget to set an alarm for that day, a reminder, whatever you need to do, be up and ready to go. That way, if you don't get a ticket, you just didn't get one. And none of us have to feel really bad about that. Anyway, guys, I appreciate it again. Tomorrow, I'll be bringing a guest on that has been on several times, but we have not heard from a while. Doctor, not Bones, not Barry, all right? That's what y'all thought I was going to say. Dr. Stephen Lewis, who's a chiropractor and really helped me quite a bit when I made the decision to go keto and lose weight with supplement recommendations that were based on laboratory results. We're going to have him on tomorrow, and I'm sure we'll talk about that some, but actually we have a different angle. We're going to talk about stress, anxiety, and depression not all being in your head, and how a nutritional approach and an activity approach can change that for you. We'll have that episode tomorrow, then an expert counsel Q&A, Friday flashback, and next week we'll do it all again. Real quick, is that Green Wisdom? Green Wisdom Health, Tom, yes. And when I saw Tom, just me watching this week, I'm done with my part, Tom, but I can't pick on Tom. I kind of drug ass the last month. But the entire cover crop and backyard soils course is done now. The exams are done. Everything is over to Tom's side. As soon as he tells me we're going to open that for sale, we talked about pricing on it. I put a lot into this. It's about 12 hours of instruction. It's very deep. It's college level, but I think I've made it understandable enough for anybody. $80, MSB 65. So that's an over 20% discount for MSB. So I think that's a pretty damn good discount right there. And we should have that for sale sometime this week. If not, it'll be next week. Thanks to you all, and have a great day.
You should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.